Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. On today's episode, Drs. Jonathan Chang and Ajay Khurian join me for a journal club. We first review an exciting article just published online in Investigative Ophthalmology and Visual Science, describing a successful animal model utilizing anti-VEGF medication in a drop form. We then review a publication from the American Journal of Ophthalmology about the correlation between central retinal thickness and visual acuity for different VEGF-responsive disease states based on major prospective clinical trials. Remember that you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 51 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal, Round, and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. If you enjoy the podcast, you will enjoy our blog, which will feature weekly posts from myself and the show's producer, Louis Kai. I'll have a new blog post up this weekend. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Those positive reviews will help us as we continue to grow and expand our scope.
Hello?
Hey, what's up, man?
Hey, Jay.
John, how are you?
Good.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with Journal Club. First, our two guests today, Dr. Jonathan Chang from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. John, thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me again.
And then Dr. Ajay Khurian from the University of Rochester. Ajay, good to have you back.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks again for having me.
And Ajay and I are fresh off the North Coast Retina meeting at Coli. In Cleveland, which had an intraoperative OCT summit, which was really nice to see, and there's some good, great cases that were presented. But we're going to talk a little bit about two very interesting papers that came out recently. So the first one we're going to talk about is entitled Topical Delivery of Anti-VEGF Drugs to the Ocular Posterior Segment Using Cell-Penetrating Peptides. So it's a very, already from the title, it's a very interesting concept. It was published in IOVS. I believe released online in May 2017. I don't know the exact date. DeKogan was the primary author. Ajay, do you want to kind of tell us briefly a little bit about what they set out to do in this study?
Sure. So this is a really interesting study that was looking at the use of these CPPs, which are essentially cell-penetrating peptides that act as chaperone to bring in anti-VEGF medications like bevacizumab, which is what they looked at in the paper, into the eye. And so it greatly increases the ocular penetration of bevacizumab, and they were able to show that they were able to get the medication into the anterior chamber and into the posterior chamber very effectively. They did some in vitro studies showing safety of this to retinal pigment epithelium cells. But most impressive is that they created a CNVM model and actually showed that with the CPP bevacizumab drops, they can actually inhibit the CNVM size the same way that we'd expect with an intravitreal injection.
And let's talk about, before we get into take-home points and what this means going forward, any major limitations you encountered when you were reading this?
So I think overall the study was very well done. I think it would have been nice to see some ERG data, and so they did some histology data and some in vitro studies, but it would have been great to have that ERG data as well anytime that you're introducing a medication into the posterior chamber. But overall the study was very well done. It is a very early study. It's still in the preclinical phase, and so there certainly is a long way to go before we're looking at this in the clinic, but it certainly is very exciting to see the potential of being able to deliver our medications by drops.
And you bring up the ERG issue because of toxicity?
Yes, yep.
John, when you encountered this and kind of read through it, what were kind of your initial thoughts?
Well, I think, like Ajay said, you know, anytime we can potentially change a therapeutic modality from giving injections in the eye to something like drops, it certainly seems very appealing. You know, as safe as injections are, it is a lot of time spent for patients, and not, you know, I think there was a paper recently where they showed it, like, the anxiety that patients have around their injections is, like, very, very high on, you know, even on a semi-monthly basis, you know, more than monthly basis, they get very nervous or just concerned about the visits. And so, sure, anything I think that you could do to relieve all that would be terrific. Probably the biggest question I have, which, because I'm not a basic science researcher, is, you know, how frequently is it that you can find proteins, you know, how permeable is a mouse or pig cornea compared to a human cornea? And, you know, how often is it that we find drugs or proteins that can penetrate well into a mouse or pig cornea, but then it turns out in humans it's just not enough or doesn't work properly? So that would be kind of my basic question.
Right. And the other things, you know, and this is taking a whole nother level, because, you know, just to quickly break it down for, you know, sometimes we have medical students or early residents kind of who are still learning about the process. But as Ajay mentioned, this is preclinical data. This is non-human model. And then typically what will happen is you'll go through phase one trials to kind of assess safety, that there's no toxicity from the drug. Then you have your large randomized prospective phase two and three trials. And there's a whole series of steps and step-ups in terms of the study requirements in order for a drug finally to hit the market. It's not like an instant thing. And we've seen, Ajay, remember we talked about PVR. You talked about multiple medications that had looked good in animal models but just didn't pan out in human models when you did a randomized, when people did randomized controlled trials. So, you know, and John, to John's point a little bit too, I'm not a basic scientist, so I'm going to defer to Ajay and be interested to hear your thoughts. What have you experienced? I mean, you don't use drops for a lot of studies, but do you have any insights into permeability, whether there's a transitive property there to between these models and human models?
You know, I'm not sure about that. They were concerned about the corneal thickness, and so mice have much thinner corneas. And so the reason why they use the porcine eye is to try to get a thickness that's more similar to humans. And so I think that helps. But you know, there's always changes between species, and certainly when you're looking at rodents and pigs compared to humans, that's a pretty big step. I don't know the exact details about the permeability, but as you alluded to, you know, throughout the basic science literature, there's a lot of things that worked really well in animals, but just didn't make that step to humans. And so, you know, this is a really exciting study, and I think that the results are great, but we're still a pretty far away before being able to say that this would work in humans.
I'm not going to mention people by name because this is off the record, but you know, a couple of faculty members who I looked this article with or shared this article with, the one concern they expressed, and they had some experience with maybe different versions of these cell-penetrating peptides, is that they don't have the best durability in the sense of shelf life, right? So getting way ahead of ourselves, if this was something that could one day hit the market and the patient could get drops instead of injections, the question is, how long could you make this last for? Because these peptides tend to be fragile, they need to be stored carefully, and they tend for, again, this isn't just based off the record, but I was told, was that they don't necessarily, outside of a very controlled lab setting, really stay intact.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And so, you know, we think about the convenience of, you know, drops versus injection, but obviously if you need to pick up your drops every week, that's not going to be a very practical kind of modality. And you also wonder, you know, how expensive would something be? You know, maybe, you know, cost would become a big consideration also.
You've done a ton of research, John, into cost effectiveness, quality research, and obviously everything comes down to and what this ends up costing, but will this end up being more cost effective than a bevacizumab injection every month, for example?
Right. And you know, an injection might be, if, you know, bevacizumab is probably less than even $100 for a lot of practices. But then obviously there's the visits and the imaging and stuff. And so would you still have a paradigm where you need to visit still every month? Maybe you need a booster of an anti-VEGF injection or something. You can almost imagine something where these drops have marginal benefit. They cost a lot. And then you're kind of in a tough spot where they're still getting injections, maybe slightly less frequently, but you're still coming in. And now you have to take this drop on top of it and almost, I mean, I don't want to say it makes things worse. Obviously, if there's some benefit, that'd be great. But, it would certainly add a layer to the treatment. Now, okay, not only do you have to come in for your visits, but make sure you take your drops twice a day, which, by the way, they don't last that long. So you need to refill them pretty often. They cost a lot. I think we all would agree, like the dream would be, you have some kind of topical therapy that, would work, with minimal side effects, low cost, and really help be as effective as injections. Obviously it's great that it appeared in this article that it was as effective, in mice and penetrated through the pink cornea. So I guess we'll just have to see. It's certainly exciting to pay attention to, for sure.
Right, and again, other things we don't know. Maybe this drop will work great, but will be super toxic to the epithelium or very difficult for patients to tolerate. We find out side effects in the glaucoma experience has given us a lot of experience into the different side effects of various drops that don't become predictable until you start using them significantly, like prostaglandins and periorbital atrophy, and other side effects from these drops. But again, we're not trying to be Debbie Downers. I think overall, this is a very exciting study. It was really well done. And as you said, John, a lot of future directions are possible. Just again, the cautious approach is just to see where this goes from here. But it's cautiously optimistic would be the way I think we all feel about this.
And you never know, maybe coupling this as an eye drop doesn't work, but what if it becomes something where you can make a depot or something, subconjunctival or subphenoms, and you get additional absorption, so maybe it's not as risky an injection, right? You may still get a subconjunctival injection, but at least, the risk of intravitreal complications is reduced. So, those kinds of things even would be, I think, a huge benefit. So, we'll just have to see, I guess, with, how the drug delivery pans out. And, that in general, right, biologics, that's the difficulties. They don't cross the cornea well. So maybe this doesn't turn out for anti-VEGF, but then some other biologic, it's extremely helpful for. So, from that standpoint, it would be, very exciting. So I guess we'll just have to see,
Any final thoughts before we move on, Ajay?
I think the other thing that the glaucoma literature also taught us is compliance issues. And so that would definitely come into play more than what we're experiencing now with intravitreal injections, where usually the only issue of compliance is a missed appointment, and then you can call them and get them back, but you know how much they're getting at every single visit. And that might be a little bit more of an issue that we face with drops.
Yeah, the only counter argument I would make, and again, people would slack off more as time went on, but glaucoma patients in general can't feel if their IOP is going up and they're being non-compliant. It's kind of like blood pressure medication, right? A lot of people are non-compliant with blood mm-hmm. pressure medication because it's an asymptomatic disease until it's too late sometimes. But with the hope would be, because a lot of patients are exquisitely sensitive to when their injections are wearing off or when they're due for another injection. The hope was even if someone's slacking off a little bit, that maybe, again, as they got symptomatic, they're using it again, but we don't, again, we're going way ahead of ourselves, but we maybe playing catch up like that isn't quite as good as getting an injection, because you need that constant kind of therapy over time to build up enough steady state levels versus you can't just like put it in when you feel like you need it. And that's, again, I'm getting way ahead of ourselves, but just maybe a counter argument to that.
Yeah. I mean, to jump ahead too with you, Jay, like what happens when you inherit a patient that you've never seen before and they're on these drops and they have what you think is dry AMD, kind of now what, is that something that you would continue, or is that something that you might stop? And
if we're gonna go this far, no one is going to inject dry AMD patients with anti-VEGF to prevent wet macular degeneration, because the risk benefit profile doesn't match up there. But then the question comes: if you could put them on a drop or a less frequent dose of an anti, would you, if you were a dry macular degeneration patient and you had wet AMD in one eye and high-risk dry AMD in your other eye, and you could take a drop once a day or twice a day and decrease your risk of conversion to wet. We don't know. I mean, who knows? Maybe that is something, because the risk-benefit profile is different, that it becomes something more feasible to study.
Well, it's like, do you tell your non-macular degeneration patients to take AREDS vitamins? You know?
Right, but that was evaluated, right? We do have at least a big national study evaluated. The problem is, no one's going to do a dry AMD injection anti-VEGF study simply because, again, it's invasive, right? You're sticking a needle into someone's eye every month.
Oh, I see.
Without benefit. Yeah. My point is, you could do a study easily with anti-VEGF drops and see if you can get prevention or prophylaxis in a way, maybe. Who knows? I mean, again, we're getting
that's a good point.
Yeah, it would definitely be interesting to study, but then you also have to worry about increasing geographic atrophy rates and things like that. And so I think certainly doing a study would be helpful, but we might not see the results that we would expect.
All right, so let's move forward. So our second paper we're going to talk about is called Relationship Between Visual Acuity and Retinal Thickness During Antivascular Endothelial Growth Factor Therapy for Retinal Diseases. It was by Wu et al. It was published online in American Journal of Ophthalmology in May 2017 as well. I feel like I'll get stones thrown at me because the senior author is Charlie Wyckoff, who I feel like we review one of his papers every single time we're here. But he writes good papers, as I said, and they're interesting, and they're very clinically relevant. So, John, do you want to tell us a little bit about what they set out to do in this study?
Sure. This is a retrospective study. They looked at some data that was already existing from prior prospective clinical trials for ranibizumab treatment for AMD, diabetic macular edema, and then retinal vein occlusion. And they were looking to see if there was any relationship between the OCT central retinal thickness and then also the best-corrected visual acuity. So they performed, I think it was a Pearson's correlation coefficient, to see if there was any relationship. The six studies, I think, looked at about just under 400 eyes. And in general, what they had found was there was not very much of a correlation in AMD or retinal vein occlusion, but there was a relatively strong correlation between the retinal thickness and visual acuity in diabetes. And this seems to be fairly consistent with prior work as well. I think DRCR looked at that in Protocol A also.
Ajay, you're our limitations guy. Anything substantial you saw in terms, I mean, there's some obvious limitations in terms of you're pooling data from multiple large studies that all had kind of different inclusion criteria and also protocols. But any major other limitations that stood out to you?
Those were the main limitations. I think they did a good job of acknowledging those limitations in the discussion and sort of pointing that out as something that people should keep in mind when looking at this study. But overall, I think they did a good job at analyzing this data. And certainly, as I pointed out in the discussion, this doesn't capture everything. And so, just like the results bear out, the central retinal thickness is certainly not the be-all end-all for visual acuity, but they did have some interesting findings.
Yeah, so interesting things from this study, which again, John, you mentioned, and they mentioned, other studies have kind of borne this out. Anatomic results don't always reflect functional results. And visual acuity is our essential measure in studies of patient function, right? It's function versus anatomy. And they don't always line up. So many of us, we've all had mentors, or maybe the same mentor, kind of tell us you treat the patient, not the OCT. And part of this from the data here, that their visual acuity and central retinal thickness don't always line up. We all know that. The interesting thing is how it varies for different disease conditions. Any thoughts about that, John? I know they kind of made some points about why that might be, but were you surprised at all in terms of, for example, DME has this relationship, but it doesn't really bear out for RVO?
Well, I think when you think about these diseases, how they look on OCT kind of varies, right? And they point this out pretty well, but, we could just go through them each. For macular degeneration, sure, when there's less fluid, typically vision's improved. However, if someone's had long-standing, you know, dry or geographic atrophy or, you know, kind of advanced macular degeneration, their retina will be thin and the vision will be pretty poor. So that almost makes some sense, you know. You wonder, I was kind of thinking about this as we were looking through the article, is would kind of segmenting this into people with retinal thickness greater than, say, 250 or 220, see if there's a linear relationship. And then, you know, or see if it's maybe a curve, right? You know, maybe it's better to be kind of mid-range, but it's not linear, you know? Then retinal vein occlusion, same thing. You know, you have an ischemic retinal vein occlusion, the retina is going to be a bit thinner maybe afterwards. And that's going to limit your vision regardless of the edema. We've seen all those patients who have 20/100, yet they have no edema when you've treated them with anti-VEGF. And then maybe diabetics, well, they can also have thinning from vascular problems. As well, maybe it's just not as common, you know, overall, that many diabetics with macular edema, retinas are generally okay, you know, maybe they just don't have as much perfusion abnormality for whatever reason. You know, I think the other thing with vein occlusion I was thinking was some vein occlusions also, you know, have some concurrent arterial occlusion, but we may not always check for that with an FA or something. And so that would also show some retinal thinning, yet not have very good vision. So, you know, maybe it's the diabetics, that's why the correlation is the best, because the retina is relatively healthy, you know, even though we know that diabetic maculas are not exactly the same as healthy individuals, that's why it kind of works out a little better.
Yeah, and the RVO thing, we've all seen patients who come in 20/400, you know, florid, cystoid macular edema, but they look ischemic, maybe the inner retina is very hyper-reflective and slightly thickened when they initially present on their OCT. You do a single injection, they come back in a month, you look at the chart before you look at the OCT, the vision's still 20/400, you look at the OCT, and it's completely flat, but now you're starting to see that atrophy. Then the diabetes question comes, you know, you can have macular ischemia and macular edema coexisting, and the most common reason diabetics would get thinning would be macular ischemia. But certain patients tend to be perfused but leak, and they develop vision loss due to macular edema. And some patients have poor perfusion but yet have much less leakage, because, again, you need some, in theory, you just need some perfusion in general to get leakage. And so maybe they're isn't as much an overlap between those patients with macular ischemia and macular edema for diabetes. Ajay, anything to add to that?
You know, I think the point that John brought up about the thinning and cutting that out would actually be a fantastic idea for analyzing this. In some other study that I've done with epiretinal membranes, we actually did do something like that, and that actually had a big effect on the results. And so I do think that just like John was saying, that you know, you can use the OCT thickness as a sort of as a surrogate for macular edema if you cut out those thin retinas. And you know, certainly there's other things that are much harder to list in a study, like ellipsoid zone integrity, ELM integrity, and other things like that have been found to be important, that I think you know, are important independent of the retinal thickness, that are just much more tedious to put into a big study compared to looking at the central retinal thickness.
And, you know, they mentioned things, too, about AMD, where, you know, pigment epithelial detachments, how do you kind of count that, and, you know, where's the measurements and that kind of thing. And so, you know, AMD is not maybe all the same exact process or the same exact appearance, but that also may play a role in kind of why the results are a little bit harder to keep in, you know, put all in one line or one best fit curve kind of thing.
Anything here that kind of changes, and we kind of talked a little bit about this, but anything here that changes the way you think of these disease states or how you manage your patients with injections?
I mean, I think where this really can be helpful is when you talk to patients, especially diabetics maybe, you know, is where you say, this helps reinforce the idea, you know, of, okay, let's try to get this edema taken care of, you know, and so you maybe would continue to treat, you know, if you see relative improvement in the edema, or maybe make sure that you really keep them, you know, without much fluid, either maybe changing your regimen if you feel like it's not as effective, and that might, but that, you know, sometimes it's also just nice to talk with your patients and kind of provide almost like a coaching, you know, hey, look, it's improving. It may take some time, but, you know, we are getting the anatomic improvement, at least in diabetes. You'd have a good basis for saying that's also going to be a good sign for your overall vision.
Well, guys, thank you again for joining me. As always, it was a good run. Now we can switch to the less scientific part of the podcast, where we're two games into the NBA Finals, and this podcast is almost certainly going to post after the finals are over. I said before the series, Warriors in five. Ajay, you texted me Warriors in six. John is not on the record with anything. So I'm going to, I don't like revising my prediction, but I think Warriors in four now. Do you guys have any thoughts on where you think this is going to go?
I mean, they just look so good. You know, LeBron played two amazing games.
Spoken like
right?
A Knicks fan who hasn't seen basketball this good in total in the past 10 years.
I don't even know what sport this is. Yeah, I mean, they're pretty good. I mean, LeBron James obviously did really well last year against a similar situation, but I mean, the Warriors were that much better this year. It's hard to imagine that the Cavs could come back, you know, especially with this hole, but I probably would think Warriors in five, you know.
Ajay, are you going to back off six, or are you sticking with it?
I think I'm coming down to five.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's scary. You know, the thing is, the scores don't reflect how close. I mean, I think the first game was actually not as close as it was, even though it was 21 or 22. I think the Warriors were like 30 points better. I think the second game, I felt like it was actually fairly tight. It just all of a sudden fell apart for Cleveland in the third quarter. You know, they missed a couple of shots, you know, that they should have made. And then the Warriors got on transition and hit a couple threes. And the next thing you know, you're down four. And the next thing you know, you're down 12, right? The game's over. I still wonder, man. This team, I really think they're amazing. I think they're really good. I just want to see at least one game where it comes down close near the end and they have to execute. And it's not because I don't trust them in close games, because they won a lot of close games last year and they won 73 games. But I just want to see what they look like if they're under some pressure, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think they're going to win the next two.
You know, the thing with the Warriors is that if, you know, one guy has a bad game, well, there's still, you know, two other of the top, you know, five players, top four players in the league ready to
Kevin Durant's playing like the best basketball I've ever seen him play. I mean, he's in total been amazing. What do you guys think of this? You know, people are talking about this competitive balance thing. Like, this is bad for the league. None of this has ever happened before. And, you know, I don't know. The Heat, people said the same thing about the Heat when they came together. You know, the Bulls, Jordan's Bulls won six titles in 8 years. No one was complaining when Shaq and Kobe were on the same team. Now, none of those teams had this level of dominance. But, you know, I think that – I don't think it's bad. I mean, I think especially if they sweep, it may be good for the league. It's really impressive what they're doing.
I don't know. I like seeing competitive playoff series and especially the finals. You know, we never know what will happen. The Cavs were down last year too, and they came back, but this is a very different team, and I don't imagine that happening. But, you know, it just... It's tough when it feels like there's an inevitable winner for the championship every year. And with that core, at the ages they are, it's just hard to see anybody else toppling them unless there's big movements.
The thing is, you can't project, because injuries, they have been relatively injury-free the last couple of years. Kevin Durant, you know, when there was a brief 24 hours when he hurt his knee, people were wondering whether he was going to be done for the year. You know, Draymond Green plays a very physical, demanding style. You know, Steph Curry's ankle. I actually think of the four of them, the one who's going to last the longest is probably Klay Thompson, just because he plays like this very low energy consumption, you know, doesn't dribble a lot, doesn't take a lot of contact game, and he never really seems to be hurt. But I think that I don't know. I just don't like projecting that stuff because the Heat were supposed to win every title for years, and then Wade gets old really fast, then Bosch ends up with blood clots. I mean, you never know what's going to happen. It's really hard to win titles. I think we should minimize how hard it is to win even back-to-back titles. The Warriors couldn't do it last year.
Yeah, I think, Jay, you know, everyone wants to feel like their team has a chance, and whether that's real or not, you know.
But we both know that's not true about our teams.
Well, if you look at the NFL, everyone thinks it has such good competitive balance, right?
Yeah. But basketball's never had that. The favorites always win in basketball.
Right, but I think people still felt like their team had a chance, right? And I think that's where people now, the criticism comes because they feel like they don't even have a chance. But I'm with you, Jay. I think this is too short term to really take this all in. You know, it's just one season. We don't know what next season will bring, you know. You don't know what it looks like 5 years from now. And, maybe they're just a really amazing team and it's unique to the situation. This draft class is supposed to be pretty good. Maybe there's a little more to come from them. I think, you know, all these leagues go through kind of ebbs and flows. And sometimes there's teams that are really, really good and they win. And it seems like you just never have a chance. And maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just brief. From the Knicks standpoint, going to be another probably 4 or 5 years before they have anything.
So but, last question for you. Ajay's already put in his best case and worst case scenario for the Knicks draft pick. What's yours? Who do they pick in your best case scenario? Who do they pick in your worst?
I don't know enough about the players. I would say worst case is they trade the pick.
For Mo Harkless.
and they re-sign Derrick Rose. I mean, that's probably the worst case. The best case would be that they
don't trade the pick.
maybe they pick someone who can start, or they trade in to get more than one pick, maybe. I mean, I think trading the pick, if they got multiple picks, might be okay. But
I mean, they have long-term holes at every position except Porzingis' position, basically, right? They don't have anyone else on that team worth getting excited about for the future, right? Unless I'm wrong. You know their roster better than I do.
I would say picking someone who's going to start and, you know, I think the other worry everyone has is, are they going to pick someone who's like a very triangle offense oriented person? Because, you know, I would agree that that's probably not a good scenario either.
Well, we've been running the triangle offense this whole podcast, and I don't think we've scored a point yet. So, all right, guys. Well, thank you so much for your time. It was great talking to both of you. John, we had a chance to catch up with a couple of your senior faculty members who came to the meeting, and they both said things were good up in Wisconsin, so I'm sure your weather's better than ours down here where it's raining like every day for the last 3 or 4 days. Guys, take care. I'll talk to you soon, and enjoy the rest of the games.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jay.
Bye-bye.
Take care, Jay. Thanks again for having me.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to Dr. Jonathan Chang and Ajay Kurian for joining me. Thanks to Louis Kai for his great production as usual. Finally, thank you, the listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here on the show. Just some bookkeeping notes, Dr. Matt Weed and I will review common maculopathies next week. We also have a pre-fellowship Q&A session coming up. So if you are entering vitreoretinal surgical fellowship and you have questions about things you may encounter, please send them in to retinapodcast@gmail.com. We'll keep all questions anonymous, and we'll have our panelists answer them live on the show. This is Jay Sridhar, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.